I've been requested to, this is a rerun of a class that I gave, seminar they call it, in Radadesh just recently. And I had six sessions. Well, there's five lectures, and then there are five sessions, and then actually an evening lecture, so I had six sessions, about an hour and a half, to do this, and I could have done a lot more, spent a lot more time on this, but now I'm going to try to compress it a little more. So I was asked this time by Shonaka Rishi to give some kind of principles and history of reform in ISKCON. Now, I've written about this stuff before, and I guess the reason that I got called upon this to begin with is, you may know or not know that in 1987, well, it finished in 1987, or reached a climax in 1987, there was something in ISKCON called the Guru Reform Movement, which really started about 84, and was pretty much centered around the temple presidents and Prabhupada disciples in North America. So I ended up being the leader of that movement, one of the leaders of the movement, and I wrote some papers, and the papers that I wrote got circulated all over, and sort of that's how I got to be a leader. And I have some of those papers to pass out to you, historic documents from 1984-85, so you can get an idea. But in order to understand what this means about, this was called Guru Reform, but really the process of reform in ISKCON is something that has to be continuous, ongoing, non-stop. If you don't keep renovating the path of Dharma, it just keeps falling apart all the time. And we've had a lot of problems in ISKCON. I mean, in 19... Why is this switching off? Okay. In 86, really what happened was within 1 year we lost Kirtanananda, Bhavananda, Rameshwara, and what was the other one? Bhagavan, all in 1 year, it was quite traumatic. But before then, we had lost Hamsaduta and Jayatirtha, and so all these things were creating a great deal of problems in ISKCON. And unfortunately, since that time, we haven't stopped having gurus fall away from Krishna consciousness. So we have to understand this, and historically, one way of that the history helps us do is understand the situation we're in, help us to deal with it ourselves personally, and also help us to keep from making the same stupid mistakes over and over and over again, we hope. So, but I'm beginning this history 1936. The first thing I want to tell you about is what happened with the Gaudiya Mutt, because they had a big crisis. They had big gurus fall down. They had fights with each other. And all of this was going on a long time ago. And when you look at it, you find out that the same issues were involved as were involved later in ISKCON. And this will help us understand what's going on. The next thing after we talk about 36 through the early 40s, then we can discuss. I want to discuss some things that happened in ISKCON from 1967 to 1977, the so-called golden years. There's this idea going around that while Prabhupada was here, everything was wonderful. Everybody followed authority. Everybody felt secure. There were no problems. This is a myth, and I want to demythologize those early days. So you can just, and it'll also help understand what happened after Prabhupada left. And then the final part, I have a more detailed chronology which I'll hand out from 78 to from 77 to 87. Some of the events that happened up to there, and that's as far as I had time for, was to go up to 1987. When there was almost after Prabhupada left, there was immediately dissension and turmoil and difficulty involving the issue of gurus and leadership in ISKCON. What scholars call the problems of succession. That's when a big leader, a charismatic leader, leaves in religious organizations, there's quite often some kind of crisis of succession where new people have to take his place and have to be seen as legitimate and authorized, and sometimes it doesn't work. But first of all, I want to tell you a few things. This is billed as a kind of history, but it's not really proper history. Because first of all, I'm a participant in many of these events personally, so that makes me not detached and disinterested, and the events are still, the whole issue is still going on, and I'm still a participant, and I have a certain ideas about what the outcome ought to be and what we ought to do. So this isn't a kind of detached academic disinterested sort of history. So that's one thing I just want to warn you about. The other thing is that when I describe things that happened, I haven't really been able to do a lot of systematic gathering of information from a lot of people. Like if I were going to do a proper history of the events in ISKCON, I would have to go around and talk to people all over the world. I was a participant in these events. What happened right in front of me or that I did are very, I know about. But things were going on, and I know about what was happening in North America, but things were going on in Europe, things were going on in India, about which I'm less well informed. As a result, this will be a little egocentric. In other words, it'll be from my point of view, and my own activities will probably be more exaggerated. Their importance will be more exaggerated, so you have to take that into account. There's a third problem involved in this, and that some of the participants in some of these events are still present in the movement and active in good standing and doing good work, yet some of the things I would say about them may not be, they may not like it so much. My father was a professional military officer in the United States Army, and he spent some time of his career serving in the Southeast Asia Operations Desk in the Pentagon, the military headquarters. I used to pick him up from work sometimes, and he would talk to me about what was going on. And he had one day once, this is the early 60s, he had a frustrating day because some reporters were trying to get some documents which were still secret, and they were unable to make them public. And he mentioned to me that the documents involved things that happened during World War II. And I was shocked. You know, his World War II is long gone. Were you still afraid of the Japanese or something? And he says, no. He says, you don't understand. We released these documents. All our heroes will look like idiots. So some things, I still may not tell you some people's names and things like that. I just want to warn you. Now, first I want to talk to you about certain issues that come up, and that we'll see these same issues came up after Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's disappearance. Because if you Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, if I can speak this way, is really the cause of a lot of our problems. Because he's a revolutionary. It was his work as the Acharya to take a tradition that had grown up and been nurtured in India and in America. I don't know, you know the word retrofit, where you take a piece of technology and you redo it so it comes up to date. You retool, you retrofit, you renovate something. He changed this tradition so that it would be able to spread all over the world. That's what Bhakti Siddhanta did. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had ideas about this, but he didn't he practiced a very traditional kind of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. The one who really was the big change maker and also an agitator was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And so he made these certain changes and these adaptations. And what you're going to discover is that some of these changes has just taken several generations to figure out how to make it. What we're doing is no little thing. Some of our problems with gurus are still part of those changes. And the Gaudiya Math tried and failed. And again, ISKCON is trying, and we're making progress toward the site. So I have to explain to you what Bhakti Siddhanta was actually doing when he was this is supposed to be plugged in, but it's not. It's running on battery. That's why I keep having this problem. Either that's not got current in that socket or something else is wrong. Everything together? Then you know what? There's no electricity or power in that PowerPoint. There's one back here. Let's try that one.
Want to hand me that?
I kept wondering when my computer screen kept switching off.
Works
now? Something happened, yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. I think that does it. Yeah, now we're good. Thank you. So I want to discuss these changes. They were dealing with these changes. One is an external change, which is the style of management or leadership from a traditional system of leadership and management by a guru to the idea of the GBC. The second thing is there was an internal change into the culture, the way devotional service was cultured. Bhaktisiddhanta took a tradition that was practiced by Babaji's in recluses, and which was a movement of Uttama Adhikaris, and changed it around to be a preaching movement of Majjhima Adhikaris. That's what he did. And so he made certain changes which were not appreciated by everybody in the surrounding community. So those things, were issues then. Second of all, in the Gaudiya Math, you may know the story, which I'll tell you a little, maybe some more about. I'll tell you more about. After Bhaktisiddhanta left, a person named Ananta Vasudev Das became the Acharya, and he fell down. And not only did he fall down, but he went over to became a big person in the camp of the enemies of Bhaktisiddhanta. And so they had to also deal with this whole big guru fall down. So that's another issue that they had to deal with. So So I want to look at that first, and you'll see, I think you'll see what's going on. Now, there's a traditional way of leadership in India, which is a kind of old-fashioned or archaic model of leadership, in which a leader is an individual with great personal power. The scholars give it this word, Max Weber, actually the German sociologist, charisma. Charisma means a kind of personal power. And because of that personal power, the leader, it may be political leadership, it may be religious leadership, it could be all different kinds of institutions. And that person gathers people around, and then an institution will form about that charismatic leader. So the way it goes is there's one person, one institution. An institution that's still structured like that is the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope is, in fact, the personal embodiment of the Church. And is in principle a total autocrat. There's a curia and other things that work really hard to stop him from doing what he wants, but in practice, but that's what he is. Kings used to be like that, so that the institution, the country or the institution, was really just a sort of an extension of the person of the leader. You'll see in old literature in the Middle Ages, the King of England is just called England. The King of France is just called France, because they are the country. And there's almost like a mystical sort of a union between the person and the institution. And this is also has been a tradition in India with this style of leadership. It has advantages and it has disadvantages. One disadvantage is the requirements for leadership of an institution like that, if it gets very, very, especially gets very big. If the institutions are small, it's not so bad, but if they get very large, you need to be a super person, like a Superman or something, in order to do it. If it's a Krishna institution, you have to be something quite a bit better than a mere pure devotee. You could have a pure devotee who's a resident of Vaikuntha or Krishna Loka, but who couldn't handle the institution at all. Because you have to have all kinds of powers and skills which may not be not normally available to people. And if you have an institution which has a person like that at the head, it requires a super qualified person. And if there's no one who's qualified, still the demand is that you find one. Somebody has to take that place. And so somebody who's not competent is put in place, and then all kinds of troubles come about. Also, such an position which is autocratic, autonomous, you don't answer to anybody, is very tempting to people sometimes because of the power and the position. So that's a standard sort of an institution. Now, what was decided by Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta was that if you were going to have a worldwide institution was going to function in the modern world, and that would be stable over long periods of time and over a wide area, this form of management would not work. It's inherently unstable. What if you have five qualified people? Each person has his own institution. because the institution would center about a person. That person would gather followers, and so you have a tendency to fragment. If you have so many qualified people, or people at least who can get some kind of following based on the conviction of their spiritual potency. And if you have no one, then you have big problems because somebody has to take that post anyway. And the tendency is that that sometimes these don't last very long. They fall apart if no one qualified is there. So anyway, there was this notion that for the future of the Krishna consciousness movement, there would be a modern corporate form of organization. This is not traditional in India. It's a radical departure. And that corporate board, the board of directors of a corporation, Bhaktisiddhanta gave the name GBC, right? Governing Body Commission. As a native American speaker of English, that phrase has a very distinctive British sound to it. We in America would never say, first of all, body, governing body, and commission. That's very British. And that's where it comes from, because there was one institution that the British put in India that I think impressed people more than anything else as the epitome of efficient modern management, and that was the Indian Railways. And the board of directors of the Indian Railways is called the Governing Body Commission. That's what it's called. This is where it comes from. This is where it's come from. I remember when the first time when I went to Mayapur and I went into the room where the GBC met, and I was really struck by it because I was thinking, you know, when we have board meetings in modern America, usually there's one big table and people have chairs like this, you know, that swivel back and forth and they're around the table. And the chairman sits at the head of the table. That's the thing. But what I saw in Mayapur, there was this big room, maybe about twice as long as deep as this one. And instead of having chairs like this around a table, all around the edge, there were huge stuffed easy chairs and sofas. So when you sat in them, you sank down completely, you know, like it was out there. And I saw this arrangement, and I thought, I know this from somewhere. This is familiar. And then I remember when I read the novels of Charles Dickens, which very nicely capture 19th century London. There were different scenes where there would be these corporations that would meet, and he would describe the board meetings of the corporations with these big, thick, fat chairs where the members would be sitting in there, disappeared. You wouldn't see them, but only their voices would come out, you know. And these were old, overweight gentlemen, and most of them suffered from a disease called gout. Do you know what that disease is, gout? Usually the big toe hurts like hell. It's from eating too much rich food, and in the joints of your fingers you get a build up of some kind of crystals, of uremic crystals, and it hurts. It's called gout, and in those days the remedy was, especially somehow or other affect the joint of the big toe, is they would have these chairs that have some big stool and they would all sit with their gouty foot, and then there would be these little office peons running around with papers and drinks and everything like that. So when I saw those big chairs arranged like this, I knew exactly where this had come from, you know. This was 19th century England. The board of directors. So even that way, I could understand the origins of the GBC idea, where it actually came from. So in that way, this is a radical change to make. And the Gaudiya Math couldn't make it. They just couldn't. handle the change. It was such a radical break from their own experience that, I'll tell what happened on this. So that was one change. The idea was to I think, to preserve the traditional guru-disciple relationship that's in Shastra, but to incorporate that relationship with many different gurus and all their different disciples in one unified, overarching organization. That's very hard to do. And this has been the source of all our problems, trying to do this. And it's taking several generations. Because when you do things in practice, really you have to proceed by the method of trial and error. You try something, it doesn't work. You try that, it doesn't work. You keep trying until you get it to work. That's the way usually these things are carried out. The second change that Bhaktisiddhanta made, I talked about, is is more internal, about the dominant mode of spiritual practice. When Bhaktivinoda Thakur was searching, as he describes his search in his autobiography, he was searching for Lord Chaitanya's movement. He was trying to find the authentic tradition of devotional service coming from Lord Chaitanya. But by that time, he was enormously corrupt. The word Vaishnavi was almost synonymous for prostitute, because all this tantric sahajiya stuff had become mixed up in devotional service, and it was enormously corrupt. So when finally he began to associate with people that in his judgment were pure practices of Krishna consciousness, these were a group of Babaji's, and they were practicing. They stayed in little bamboo groves. They associated with each other. They all the time meditated upon Krishna's Vrindavan Leela and discussed Krishna's Vrindavan Leela, conjugal Leela. They chanted 64 rounds a day. They were practicing spontaneous devotional service. They're extremely renounced. None of them married or anything like that. That was the way he found it. These are called, this style is called, these people are called bhajanandis. You know this this idea. They don't preach. Mahabhagavatam asvatam adhikaris, they do not preach. Because they see, the way they see the world is everybody, they see down to the reality, and what the reality is, that everybody is a devotee. They don't make a distinction between who's a devotee and who's not a devotee. The only one they consider not a devotee is themselves, because they're extremely humble. They think everyone is a devotee but me. This is their attitude, and so they are not preachers of Krishna consciousness. So Bhaktisiddhanta took this religion of first-class devotees and recrafted it into a religion of second-class devotees, Madhyama Adhikaris. And as part of that thing, he changed a few things. These highly advanced devotees who are Babaji's would practice with their disciples. They would give their disciples, engage the disciples in the process called Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, which involves usually a practice called Siddha Pranali Diksha. Raganuga Sadhana means, Siddha Pranali Diksha means that you would get a certain initiation. And it was done in this before you were on the level of complete freedom from material desires. And you would be told by the spiritual master your identity in Krishna Lila. The spiritual master would tell you 11 different things. It would go something like that. You're a gopi. You're 13 years old. This is your name. This is the village you are from. These are the clothes you wear. This is the manjari whose entourage you serve. Your service is that when Narada and Krishna are going into a grove for conjugal pastimes, you collect the flower leaves that are spread on their bed. That's what you do. That's your service. You assign your service. It's like this. He would tell a person these things, and then the person would be taught how to meditate. The devotee would be taught how to meditate on himself or in this identity herself, because it would usually be as a gopi. When meditate on Krishna's going through his lila through over the course of the day, the 8 astakalya lila, meditate on these pastimes and performing these pastimes. This is siddha pranali diksha. And it was given ajati ratihi before a person was finished with anartha nirvritti. In other words, there were still dirty things in the heart, but in this practice it was given before they had become completely pure. When Prabhupada talks about siddha pranali, one place, at least in the record, he's asked about it, and he says the sahajiyas do that. Well, they do, but it also was actually an orthodox practice. It was done by the right people in the right time, under the right circumstances. It was okay. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur practiced it. This has been dug up lately by various people around ISKCON, and they've pointed this out, that Bhaktisiddhanta practiced it. And there's doubt cast about Bhaktisiddhanta. Bhaktivinoda Thakur practiced it. And Bhaktivinoda's son, Lalit Prasad, practiced it. Bhaktisiddhanta dropped the whole thing. He didn't really have, and you know, he also did things like revive the Tridandi Sannyas, and he made a preaching movement. And now, what Bhaktisiddhanta did was not something new in our tradition, because this Siddha Pranali Diksha, we don't see any evidence that the 6 Goswamis actually practiced that. But after them, there are acharyas who did this Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti like that with this Siddha Pranali Diksha. And as I said, even Bhaktivinoda Thakur did it. So it's a legitimate part of our tradition. But there's other things too. And the other thing was taken advantage of, and in a way which was earlier, by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, which is the conviction that actually by practicing the Sankirtan movement, it's just in itself, you can come to the highest goal. Without practicing Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, but just by Vaidhi Bhakti together with Sankirtan, you can achieve the highest goal of devotional service. And so on this option, Bhaktisiddhanta, he took advantage of this. Prabhupada is explaining what acharyas do, that just like a physician may have on the shelf many different drugs or medicines, and for a certain condition, you can use any of them. But which one is appropriate depends upon the patient, and it's the wisdom of the doctor, the physician, to be able to say, this is the right one for you. This is what acharyas do. There may be other things on the shelf that are equally good, but not for this time, this place, your particular condition. So this is what Bhaktisiddhanta did. And because
It seemed that in his judgment, this Rabinuga Sadhana, this early practice of spontaneous devotional service, led to Sahajism. That was certainly Prabhupada's judgment. I mean, our Prabhupada, his judgment. And what Srila Prabhupada told us is that one should not begin even meditating extensively on the confidential conjugal pastimes of Radha and Krishna until one is completely free from sex desire. That's the other method. That's part of the other method that that Bhaktisiddhanta took. It's quite interesting. But what Bhaktisiddhanta really understood was the power of Sankirtan. There was a certain ardent eagerness to preach. In Bhaktisiddhanta there was an enormous drive to preach Krishna consciousness and save fallen souls. The strength of it, this drive, was very, very, very powerful. Sometimes people say that the qualification for entering into Krishna's confidential pastimes is greed, lobe. But the greed that we see is this, or lobe that we see is this desire to bring fallen souls back to Godhead. People sometimes talk about the activities of the gopis as the most confidential service of Krishna. But I did a little look around, and most of the time when Prabhupada is talking about most confidential service, he talks about one who saves others. Anyone here is like, for example, this is the very first time Prabhupada mentions most confidential service in the Bhagavatam. The 16th verse of the first chapter, first canto. Anyone, therefore, who takes shelter of the lotus feet of a pure devotee by accepting the pure devotee as a spiritual master can be at once purified. Such devotees of the Lord are honored equally with the Lord because they are engaged in the most confidential service of the Lord, for they deliver out of the material world the fallen souls whom the Lord wants to return home back to Godhead. So all throughout Prabhupada's teaching, you find this idea of the most confidential service to Krishna is bringing people. The guru is the confidential servant of Krishna because he canvasses from door to door saying, please become Krishna conscious and surrender unto Krishna. Over and over again, you see this with Prabhupada. Only in Chaitanya Charitamrita does he talk about the most confidential service as being the pastimes of gopis with Radha and Krishna. But in America, at least, Prabhupada made this very famous statement once, that which links these two notions. He said that book distribution was in the mood of the gopis. It was gopi bhava. Remember, there was a famous incident where devotees in Los Angeles were going to sit down and practice sort of spontaneous devotional service, and it was called the Gopi Bhava Club. And Prabhupada just really smashed it up one side, down the other. First deserve, then desire, and so on. And a little later on, he said this statement that book distribution is in the mood of the gopis. Now, I mean, I think it was misunderstood because right after that happened, the BBT Library Party in North America came to my temple. At that time, Tripurari was the leader. And they were full of this announcement that because book distribution was in the mood of the gopis, they were in the mood of the gopis and everybody else was not. And so they were better. The book distributors were better devotees than everybody else. They were the real devotees and everybody else was some kind of low class. And it really caused, I mean, suddenly in the temple there was like a big division. I could see something was wrong because all of a sudden devotees were fighting with each other and getting puffed up and angry. And then I realized something was wrong. And so after he gave his mood of the gopis class, I gave a Bhagavatam class. And I proved that the mood of the gopis is, everyone is a better devotee than I am. Which is the mood of the gopis. Because the mood of the gopis is that although they love Krishna, they're not selfish. They're not interested in their sense gratification. They're interested in satisfying Krishna. So the mood of the gopis is, if they see another gopi who's qualified, they bring that person to Krishna to enjoy. And they're always thinking, other people are more qualified than I am. And essentially, preaching or sankirtan is bringing souls to Krishna for Krishna to enjoy. So these two activities are linked in this way. And I want to share with you this other text, because people are now having doubts about this, because the same kind of wars, the same kind of thing is going on now as went on at the time of Bhaktisiddhanta. You have to understand, when Bhaktisiddhanta made this change, dropped this Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, dropped the Siddha Pranali Diksha, his disciples heard from all over the place, you're off, you're not going, well, you may go to Vaikuntha, but you're not going to go back to Krishna Loka. You have to get this diksha. If you don't get this diksha, you won't make it. Things that we are hearing, you know, just a few weeks ago, this kind of stuff was going on even then. Bhaktisiddhanta's and his students were under attack. And we're hearing the same thing. There's a text by Srila Prabodhananda Saraswati. He wrote a book of a work called the Chaitanya Chandramitra. This is the 88th text. Yata yata gaura padara vinde videta bhaktim kutta punya rashihi tata tato sarapati hridya kasmat radha padam bhoja sudambu rashihi. This says that it has this construction, yata, yata, and tata, tata, in Sanskrit. To the extent that a person who has performed volumes of pious activities attains devotional service at the lotus feet of Lord Gauranga, Gaura Padara Vinde. He attains service at the lotus feet of Lord Gauranga. To the same extent, that person will be lifted up because he will have attained in his heart, suddenly and of its own accord, volumes of the liquid nectar that flows from the lotus feet of Srimati Radharani. So, you know, there's Gaura Leela and there's Krishna Leela. So what he's saying here, that one who attains devotional service of Lord Gauranga, which is the Sankirtan movement, will automatically attain the service in Krishna Leela. He'll obtain in his heart volumes of the liquid nectar that flows from the lotus feet of Srimati Radharani. That's how they wrote in those days, very flowery. And the word that he uses here is akasmat. Riddhi akasmat. Akasmat means spontaneously, suddenly, of its own accord, without any why or wherefore, not coming from anywhere, it just will come automatically. Akasmat. So this is what you might say, that Bhaktisiddhanta made arrangement for everybody to be delivered to the highest level of Krishna consciousness. And that lay in having this eager desire to preach devotional service, preach Krishna consciousness to others. That was his reform of the tradition. And if you can look at other things that we've learned about the Sankirtan movement. If you look what Lord Chaitanya says in the Shishastika prayers about the power of Sankirtan, it does absolutely everything. Just a congregational chanting of the holy name. At the last chapter of Chaitanya Charitamrita, there is a Lord Chaitanya's own purports on the Shishastika. And the first one, Cheto Dharpana Marjana. He says when he explains it, he says by perform, this is, you know, the verse is quoted in Sanskrit, and then there's a Bengali comment, a couple of verses of commentary in Bengali by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. By performing congregational chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, one can destroy the sinful condition of material existence, purify the unclean heart, and awaken all varieties of devotional service. Sarva Bhakti Sarana Udgam. And then he says, the result of chanting is that one awakens his love for Krishna, tastes transcendental bliss, ultimately one attains the association of Krishna and engages in his devotional service as if immersing himself in a great ocean of love. Krishna Prema Udgama. It awakens love for Krishna. Krishna Prema. Prema Amrita Asvadana. Tasting of the transcendental bliss of Prema. Krishna Prapti. Attainment of the lotus feet of Krishna. And Save Amrita Samudre Manjana. Immersing a person in the ocean, Samudra, of Seva Amrita. The nectarian ocean of Krishna Seva, devotional service to Krishna. All this from Sankirtan. That's in the Anchalila. So I just want to say that I personally have no doubts about what Bhakti Siddhanta did. And certainly Prabhupada had no doubts about it. He was completely committed to his distinctive characteristic, that he took Bhaktisiddhanta very, very seriously. Because what we see is that as far as the grasping the importance of preaching and having this urgent desire to preach to others, Srila Prabhupada exhibited that far, far beyond anybody else who was a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta. You should know, I don't have time to go into all this, but you should know that the order to take Krishna consciousness and preach in the West was given very liberally by Bhaktisiddhanta. It wasn't that he picked Srila Prabhupada out and gave him this order. He gave this order to almost everybody. And the big leaders in the Gaudiya Math, they were all sannyasis. Prabhupada was a fringy householder, but in their terms, he was not very important. And he was astonished in 1936 to get a letter from Bhaktisiddhanta suggesting that Prabhupada could do this service. And Prabhupada said, I had no idea how it was possible for me to do this. I was married, he was doing business in Bombay, he got this order, he couldn't figure out how it would be possible for him to execute this order. But he said he got some inspiration when he read Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on 241, Vyavasa Atmika Buddhi, and what Vishwanath Chakravarti says, the secret of success in devotional service is to make the order of the spiritual master one's life and soul. One should not care about liberation or not liberation, success or failure, and simply execute the order of the spiritual master. That's Vyavasa Atmika Buddhi. Prabhupada said, that was Prabhupada's big breakthrough realization. In fact, I've gone through and found how many times Prabhupada refers to this commentary, either directly or indirectly, implicitly, and it's repeated, constant, that Prabhupada refers to this It was his big realization. And so he just said, somehow or other, I'm going to do this. I don't know how it can happen, but I'm going to do it. And when Prabhupada talked about this, this was in Los Angeles in 1969, he was asking the question, how is it possible that I'm born in one country and you are born in another and somehow or other we've come together? And so he said it began in 1936 when I got this letter. It was just a couple of weeks before Bhaktisiddhanta left his body. And Prabhupada said, so I've tried in some helpless way to do this. To follow this order, and now it's come out a little successful. And now we have some books, you have some understanding about this Krishna consciousness. He says, now I'm going to give you the same order that my spiritual master gave me. I'm passing it down to you in disciplic succession. He said, and then he said, what he's asking is that you should have some feeling for suffering humanity. That's how Prabhupada put it. You should understand that people are suffering in this material world and that they're really suffering from want of Krishna consciousness. There are many people trying to alleviate people's suffering by various means of material welfare, but still there's suffering, going on suffering. The only real cure for the suffering of humanity is Krishna consciousness. You should have some feeling for the suffering humanity. You should assimilate this Krishna consciousness and you should give it to others. So Prabhupada just gave that blanket order. So you may say, well, you know, he was lucky. Bhaktisiddhanta wrote him a letter saying you should do that. But Prabhupada just turned around and passed on the same order to all of us. Parampara, one after. that's how it's come down. And so what we have to learn from Srila Prabhupada is, what you can only learn by seeing it, is how driven and eager Prabhupada was to give Krishna consciousness to other people. And I think we don't see that so much to the same degree anywhere else in Bhaktisiddhanta's disciples. And because of that, I think that's where some of their problems particularly began. So what happened, the history of their dealing with this is, after Bhaktisiddhanta disappeared, Prabhupada talks about this, how they disobeyed the order of the spiritual master. He mentions this in purports to Chaitanya Charitamrita, and he speaks about it more extensively in conversations. I don't have time to read all that stuff to you. But he said, because of disobedience of the order of the Acharya, a great institution was lost, Prabhupada said. Because Bhaktisiddhanta did not appoint anybody to be his successor Acharya. He did not select anyone to be a guru, and he said instead there should be a GBC. Instead of that, they selected one person to be the Acharya. And then everything fell apart. Now, what happened, sometime in the early 80s, a group of GBC members went to Sridhar Maharaj, who was the senior person in the Gaudiya Math at that time, and asked him for his remembrance of these events. And they taped it, and I've heard the tape. I got a copy of it, and the way he tells it is that there was a GBC formed with 13 people after Bhaktisiddhanta left, but Sridhar Maharaj expressed great dissatisfaction with this GBC. He didn't like it, and Sridhar Maharaj, together with some other senior people, Sridhar Maharaj didn't like it so much that he refused to be on it. So here's an institution that gets a GBC together, but one of the senior most persons, who was one of the most educated and the most learned, wouldn't be on it. and he didn't like it. Srila Maharaj is by birth and training a Brahmana. So he was, I think, very, how do you say, very acculturated to a certain traditional style of doing things. I can see how he wouldn't have liked a GBC, where people sit around. And Prabhupada had the GBC function strictly by parliamentary procedure, from a book called Robert's Rules of Order, which is used by the English Parliament, where a motion is put on the floor, it's seconded, it's amended or amendment not, then it's voted upon, yes or no, everybody votes. This is not the traditional way. Let me tell you about the traditional way. We have, for one period of time, we had a person on the GBC who was a very traditional Indian person. This is Gauravinda Maharaj. Gauravinda Maharaj was not from the city, like Prabhupada, you know, not a Calcutta wala, as Prabhupada said. I think when he met Prabhupada, he was already renounced. He had been a school teacher in Orissa. He had retired. He had taken some kind of sannyas or babaji. He met Prabhupada in Radhakund. Then after that, he stayed in Orissa. So he was a very, very traditional, steeped in tradition, spiritual leader from India, and certainly a very advanced devotee. And when he became onto the GBC, he had a very, very difficult time dealing with this procedure. And it became clear that what his expectations was, that we junior men, because he was the oldest, he was the senior, this is the etiquette, we junior men would discuss an issue and come boil it down to either this or those, then we would ask him his opinion and he would make the decision. That's the way it's done. You think about it and everything, but ultimately you defer to the judgment of the senior person. And when that didn't happen, it was very hard for him to deal with it. It just seemed rude, a violation of etiquette. What were junior men doing disagreeing with us? On the GBC, somebody would take a position, he would take the opposite position. On the GBC, it's our business to disagree with him, because we, you know, argue things out, things out, and come to a conclusion. That's how boards work, right? And it was just a breach of etiquette. It was rude. What did, you know, some guy who just been anyway, was very, very, I felt so sorry for him. And I could understand exactly what he was going through. It didn't help that, you know, most everybody on the GBC was American, as a Iranian guy. The manners were not too formal anyway. That was another problem. But he just had trouble with the structure. So I can also imagine Srila Maharaj, you know, having the same sort of a... anyway, so Srila Maharaj, quite frankly, says he didn't like the GBC. He just didn't like it. Didn't like the idea of it. And so he was quite frank about this, because Prabhupada, in one letter, cautioning us about getting too much involved with his godbrothers, mentions that Srila Maharaj was instrumental in disobeying this order of Bhakti Siddhanta. He personally mentions his name in a letter. Although Prabhupada had a great deal of affection and good feeling for Srila Maharaj, he also had some misgivings. On the one hand, at one point the GBC really demonized Srila Maharaj, and there's other people that make him sound like he was the brains behind Prabhupada. But the real fact of the matter is that Prabhupada had mixed feelings about him. So I don't need to get into all that, but at any rate, according to Srila Maharaj himself, they decided that they needed to have an acharya. And so Srila Maharaj, together with some senior people, they selected this Ananta Vasudev Das, who was actually a brahmachari. Why did they pick him? Because Srila Maharaj says he knew the Siddhanta better than anybody else. He was very, very smart. I mean, a really good... He had the kind of a academic brain, you know, a scholar's brain. He was Bhaktisiddhanta's secretary, so he had that close relationship with Bhaktisiddhanta. He was his secretary. And they said that when Bhaktisiddhanta would give a lecture and say, mention a line, what is that verse, and say a few words, Ananta Vasudeva would know the whole verse and could quote it flat out. You know, one of those guys, a real whiz, as we say. So they elected him, they selected him to be the acharya. And everybody got initiation from him. And as he then became, as the acharya, he became the head of the Gaudiya Math. A little while later, I don't know exactly how long it was, enough for, I guess, quite a few people to get initiated. Somebody found in his room love letters from a woman. And he was carrying on, apparently, at least for the time, a pretty intimate correspondence with a woman. I don't have no idea of the content of that. But somebody brought these letters, I guess her letters to him, to Srila Maharaj. And Srila Maharaj got together with other people, and they realized they had a major crisis. This was the acharya. And they decided that he was not worthy to sit on the seat of Bhaktisiddhanta. The nature of this thing, you know, you would have that's the expression, sit at the seat at the head of the institution. Just like the Pope has a special chair, that's his seat. It symbolizes, the king has his throne, that symbolizes his sovereign power. So this is the expression. So the senior people, a delegation, approached Ananta Vasudev with the evidence and with the idea that he should step down. And he was not very accommodating. It was one of these things. You're all envious and so on. And so then there was a very difficult time, according to Srila Maharaj, because then there was two groups. There was Ananta Vasudeva and his supporters, I guess the people he initiated and some other people who were behind him. And then there are the people that were behind Srila Maharaj and the others. And Srila Maharaj says that it was very, very hard. There were very harsh words. I've even heard from other sources that there were physical fights and things like that. Very bad language, he said. He said that if you were against Ananda Vasudev, you couldn't use the good bathrooms. And they served you out old rotten prasadam. You didn't get fresh prasadam. It was like this systematic mistreatment of people. And, you know, renounced life has very few perks, very few good things to look for. Two of them are nice prasadam and a decent place to pass stool. Well, both of those things were taken away. It's very serious. Day after day. You know. So, and very, very harsh language. Then Sridhar Swami said that because Ananta Vasudev committed so much Vaishnava aparat, he then began to doubt Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And that's what happened. There were disciples who had begun to doubt him. You see, they were hearing all over the place, he's off, he's off, he's off. And one of the people that was very active at preaching against Bhakti Siddhanta to his own disciples was Bhakti Siddhanta, no less than a personage than Bhakti Siddhanta's own brother, Lalit Prasad, who was still on the planet when Prabhupada was here. Because Lalit Prasad, who Prabhupada said is an advanced devotee, Lalit Prasad was practicing the same as Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Raganuga Bhakti. And Bhakti Siddhanta was not. And Lalit Prasad did not appreciate the changes that Bhakti Siddhanta made. And so the two brothers disagreed with each other. Some disciples of Bhakti Siddhanta became affected and took reinitiation from Lalit Prasad and other people. One Sundarananda Vijayvinod, another scholarly devotee, even wrote books critical of Bhakti Siddhanta. Prabhupada mentions this. In fact, some god brothers of mine got reinitiated by Lalit Prasad. Some of Prabhupada's disciples got reinitiated. I remember in the early 70s, somebody, Gadadhar Pran, I think his name was initiated by Prabhupada. Lalit Prasad reinitiated, and he had some pamphlet or little booklet he was coming to Mayapur and handing out to all of us, telling we needed to have Siddha Pranali, Diksha, and all these other things, otherwise we were not going to attain the lotus feet of Krishna.
When did that happen?
That was in the early 70s. I probably got that little booklet somewhere if I dig around far enough. So even Prabhupada's own disciples got reinitiated by Lalit Prasad. Prabhupada told us, at first actually, Lalit Prasad was going to donate some land, so Prabhupada was sending devotees to him, but then later said, you shouldn't associate with him because he is critical of my Guru Maharaj, and you should not associate with him. That's what he told us because of this. There was doubts about Bhakti Siddhanta, about the changes he made. Connected with this is, you know, his initiations, because the Radhakun Babaji's didn't like him, because he was really ferocious. The Babaji's at Radhakund who practice this Ragmarg are, according to, I think, fairly reliable testimony from an ISKCON devotee who went to stay with him for a while and left, said they're about 90% corrupt, which is certainly Prabhupada's judgment and Bhakti Siddhanta's judgment, that in secret they had female friends and they were practicing different kinds of tantric practices involving sexual activity and so on like that. So maybe they cast doubt on whether Bhakti Siddhanta was actually initiated by Gorkhasur Das Babaji, who was a Babaji. So they said, no, he would never initiate Bhakti Siddhanta. Look at this rascal, you know, like that. And actually, there's in where is it? It's in Cologne. There's one fellow, an Indian guy, Nandulal, who's preaching the exact same thing, even now, to ISKCON devotees, that Bhakti Siddhanta wasn't initiated properly, that you need another mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra won't do the job, you need this 18-syllable Gopal mantra, and all this other kind of stuff. He comes from Vrindavan and he's preaching the same kind of stuff. So anyway, that was Ananta Vasudev then had to leave the Gaudiya Math. The Gaudiya Math tells a story, he ran off with a woman and stole the Didi's jewelry. I haven't got any independent verification of that. But he did end up somehow or other with the Radhakun Babaji's under the new name Puri Goswami. And he prepared, I told you he was very scholarly, he prepared to this day the best edition of the writings of the six Goswamis. what they call a critical edition. It was, he got together various editions of it in manuscripts and came out with the best reading of the texts of the writings of the six Goswamis. And it's a very valuable book. And when the Sanskrit department had a chance to get a hold of it, they traded somebody in Vrindavan a set of Prabhupada's books for the Puri edition of the six Goswamis. Prabhupada found out about it. He made him give it back. He didn't want Ananta Vasudeva's book in ISKCON. That's what Prabhupada thought about it. After Ananta Vasudeva left, people then there was a lawsuit. They went two parts. Sridhar Maharaj says, I had to find out what happened. He said the GBC party and the trustees party sued each other. It was the Bug Bazaar temple, the group around the Bug Bazaar temple, and the group around the yoga pit. They sued each other in the Calcutta courts for the possession of the temples. And other people went off and started their own separate organizations. And so it remains splintered to this day. And I think the law case is probably still active. So you see this difficulty in making this transition from the single institutional acharya to the idea of a GBC. You see difficulty adjusting this change in style from to a preaching mission from an exclusive sort of Bhajan Anandi Mahabhagavata mission. You see somehow or other a failure really to have confidence in the order of the spiritual master. And just follow it to wherever it leads. Lack of faith in Bhakti Siddhanta, and also certain temptations of Rag Marg. People became nervous. Will I get everything from Bhakti Siddhanta? Did he really give everything? They became nervous about that. So now you see that ISKCON actually, the same issues are there. One is making a transition to finding a way to have many gurus with many different disciples all working together in the same temple, because what was established after Prabhupada left, the so-called zonal acharya system, established basically the same system, the same style of leadership as the single acharya. But it was just done in separate zones, so that each, we thought we were great, we still had a GBC and we had gurus, we didn't fall apart like the Gaudiya Math. But what really happened is each acharya became the autocrat in his own zone, had the same relationship with his own zone that Prabhupada had had toward the whole of ISKCON, and the GBC became in effect subordinate to the initiating gurus and almost superfluous. And people were confused in the beginning because it seems like Prabhupada had set up two independent systems of authority. One the GBC and the other the gurus. It wasn't still understood yet what was actually needed, because the model for a guru was still the way Prabhupada was a guru, which was not just a guru but the acharya at the head of the institution. The reason Prabhupada had to be that way is because the Gaudiya Math failed. If the Gaudiya Math had been successful, Prabhupada or many people would have come to the West working together. They didn't. Only one person came. And ISKCON is suffering from these same problems. This transition also, we are also being attacked by almost the same groups. The main difficulty I have now with Narayan Maharaj, for example, is that he's reintroduced Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. This did not come out of the Gaudiya Math. It certainly didn't come from Srila Prabhupada. He went to a Babaji in Govardhan, who became his Rasika Guru. That's where it came from. I researched this. I talked to the people that know him. This is where it actually comes from. And even Puri Maharaj doesn't appreciate it at all, although he doesn't like to say so in public because there's a typically Indian way of dealing with things, which is quite different from the way we have to proceed now, where you just don't talk about these things. But he is in fact quite upset with Narayan Maharaj because it is not Bhakti Siddhanta's. My main difficulty with Narayan Maharaj right now, however personally realized he may be, that's another thing, but that he has in effect reversed the decision of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And if he wants to try something else, that's fine with me, no problem. But unfortunately, they're trying it out on ISKCON, which I really wish they would leave us alone so we could just pursue the course that Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta set for us. The same thing was there with this with Satyanarayan. Remember the Jiva, the fall of the Jiva issue? Satyanarayan was studying from Haridas Shastri, who was part of the circle of the Radhakund Babajis. Satyanarayan was preaching. He had Kundali as his kind of a partner, and they were preaching this thing about the Jiva. But that was only the first installment. The next installment was going to be where does bhakti come from? Because they have the Babajis have this notion that bhakti is not situated in the heart permanently, but rather it's given to you when you're initiated by the Raga Guru. So we are also suffering from the same sort of attacks. So we should understand these same problems were there before, and also the fall down of leaders and devotees that also happened to them. So Prabhupada had to come as a result of all this background. It turned out that the only person to actually come to the West to fulfill Bhaktisiddhanta's ardent desire was one lonely 70-year-old man with no money, no institutional backing. That's not what Bhaktisiddhanta wanted. He wanted a whole preaching mission to show up in the West, and it didn't happen. What happened was out of the whole rubble and the ruins of the Gaudiya Math as an international preaching mission, Prabhupada came. And so he had to do everything all by himself, which is a lot to ask of anyone. And so Prabhupada was trying to do something very, very difficult. Also now I see this, people are having doubts about Prabhupada because so many things in ISKCON have had problems and defects. And so people are wondering, well, you know, Prabhupada, maybe he could have done something else or could have done things differently, or he shouldn't have done this, he shouldn't have tried to start Gurukulas, he shouldn't have... I don't know what the different things are, but I have to say this. I think Prabhupada, his own philosophy, he's told us what it is, that you should, if you're going to go hunting, you should hunt the rhinoceros. You should, if you're going to try something difficult. Because if you succeed, it'll be wonderful, and if you fail, everybody say, oh, well, nobody could do it anyway. So he was, Prabhupada was willing to try something very, very big. And he made decisions also. We say that when he came, he had to take certain principles and try them out in new circumstances. It's one thing when they're eternal principles, to apply them in new circumstances is very, very difficult. And sometimes the only method you can use is try something, see if it works. If it doesn't work, try something else, and then you adopt your principles as much as you can to the circumstances. That's what I think Prabhupada did. Our particular failure to follow an order of Prabhupada doesn't mean it was wrong for Prabhupada to give the order. That's our failure, not his. But you should just understand that the conditions, because of the failure of Gaudiya Math, Prabhupada didn't do everything alone, and he was in a hurry. I mean, he only had, as it turned out, 11 years. He was in a great deal of a hurry, working very, very fast. People complained to him, this hasn't been done right. He mentions this in one Bhagavatam purport. People are going, this is wrong, that's wrong, this should be different, that should be different. And Prabhupada said, these people don't know, they can't do anything, but when everybody else tries, then they just complain. But he was in a hurry. The other thing is about Prabhupada, he was working with unpromising material. He complained, there's several letters where Prabhupada said, Krishna didn't send me any first class men. He only sent me third and fourth class men. That seems to be the way it works. If you study the history of religions, you find out when something new happens, it's not the establishment that joins. It's disenfranchised, marginal people. Look at the people that became the followers of Jesus, right? They weren't the big guys. They were the tax collectors, the prostitutes, right? One prostitute. Not a real high-class crowd as they go, huh? So in ISKCON also, Prabhupada said there was no first class men. So Prabhupada tried in a very short a time with this kind of people to set something up. The movement was spreading very fast, and he had to make people leaders. All you had was on-the-job training. There was no course to go to learn how to be things, how to do things. And so I think we did fail to live up to Prabhupada's standards. Not just gurus, not just sannyasis. I think it was across the board. It was across the board. Difficult, as we'll see some of the things that happened. So this anyway is a kind of summary of these early events in the Gaudiya Math, and how ISKCON has got the same kind of issues in establishing a spiritual masters and forming an institution where so many different people can work together and living up and having following the actual standards of the spiritual master. It's the same thing. Now we have people going to law courts. Calcutta court again is got our problems. I got our issues. I know apparently some judges in Calcutta now got to find out what is Guru Tattva. That seems to be what's happening. So anyway, that's the summary of the past, what happened in the Gaudiya Math. And I guess now anybody have any questions, comments? Yeah.
You're saying that traditionally they were Bhajananandis and they were we do not encourage, but if one looks back to Lord Chaitanya's movement, you see that he's preaching to everybody, and it was like there were also many initiating spiritual master cooperating. So
yeah.
There's a basis for this idea.
Yes, there is. There is. The Vishva Vaishnava Raj Sabha. I'm glad you brought that up by Rupa Goswami, that there could be many spiritual masters preaching and cooperating together. That's a fact. It just wasn't organized in this sort of legalistic, modern legalistic form of a religious corporation. And that's what sounded very, very new to people. But I think that sometime after Baladeva Vijayabhushana, the Gaudiya tradition fell on really hard times, and something especially happened in the 19th century during the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was enormously corrupt. There was a saying, you know, in Bengal: a Vaishnava by day, a tantric by night. I mean, things were really, really wild. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it, and I think it was in very bad shape by the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and so there was this cooperative spirit, at least among the fairly early Vaishnavas, but for quite some time, this notion of being this one person, one institution was pretty much there. And I don't think traditionally organizations in India had anything, even when there was a unified organization, they had anything like the kind of unity and singleness of purpose that's achieved by a modern corporation. My hypothesis, and I've asked some professors about this, I haven't investigated it, but another thing that was very, very, another English institution that was very, very powerful in India was at Serampore. There was a Baptist mission that was enormously successful and very, very well organized, and which ran in the same corporate fashion, and that made an enormous impression on everybody as a model for missionary work. And I would like to see how much Bhaktivinoda Thakur was thinking about that also. It would be interesting to see. Yeah?
So this, what's his name? Ananta Vasudev?
Ananta Vasudev Das.
He became Puri Maharaj.
Yeah, that was not any of the Puri Maharajas around now.
No.
Puri Goswami. It was called Puri Goswami. Puri Goswami. He supposedly ran off with a woman, and I don't know what the detailed history of him is. It'd be something that interesting to follow out like that. But he did join the Radhakund Babaji's, and he's regarded by people like Haridas Shastri. And by a current contemporary Babaji, Anantadas Babaji, who also writes many books, they all regard Puri Goswami as a great thinker and teacher in their line. Anantadas Babaji this is another thing that makes me a little nervous. This is the person that Narayan Maharaj uses as his reference for all the information that he has about Raghunuga Bhakti. Narayan Maharaj certainly doesn't have the time to go through all the acharyas and to find this stuff out, but Ananta Das Babaji has done so. And so what I'm told, and I was told this by people who are friendly to him, he studies these books of Ananta Das Babaji, and that's where he gains most of his information, and where it disagrees with Bhakti Siddhanta, he leaves that part out, is what I'm told. Yeah?
Yeah, this system of I don't remember the word,
Gata Gain
Initiation.
Yes, Siddha Pranali Diksha.
Yeah. Do they claim to have like a self-realized guru who can see the eternal position, or is it something he gives the disciple?
Usually it's the first. Yes, usually it's the first. Yeah. But it quickly, it quickly degenerates in many cases. usually the claim is that the guru actually knows, sees who you really are and tells you who you really are. Well, but it's not that you're really that. He makes you that.
Is that an old tradition, or did it start somewhere in the middle between Lord Chaitanya and the present time?
Yeah, well, it shows up, I think, it's in Bhishma Chakravarti and other people, but it's, you don't see this diksha, the Siddha Pranaya diksha in the six Goswamis. I have more research to do. This is sort of a work in progress, but we'll track it down in a scholarly way.
Do you know this Gadadhar Prana?
Yeah, I met him once.
What type of person is he? I mean, is he genuine? Does he really believe this?
Yeah, he really believes it.
But is he like such a self-realized person that he can tell people that?
Oh, you know, I have personally seen my own personal experience about people who are practicing Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, at least Western people, is while at the same time they're interested in Rasika, most of them are not as strict as the ISKCON devotees that follow the Princess Prabhupada laid down. It's somehow or other those two things go together, which really makes me nervous. And I fear that the widespread introduction of this, many people go to Narayan Maharaj for this kind of thing. And at the same time, the requirement for initiation, initiation in the holy name, not this other stuff, but is no requirement for numbers of rounds, not nearly as strict as Prabhupada. And so generally, you find a laxness in regular principles. Yet, same time, coupled with this notion that you're going to practice Rag Marg, I think that's a very, very dangerous combination. I personally do on this matter.
May I ask who is Narayan Maharaj and where is he staying?
Who?
Who is Narayan Maharaj? Where is he staying?
He is a disciple of one of Prabhupada's godbrothers. Keshava Maharaj was one of the leaders of the Gaudiya Math and had a temple in Mathura. And that particular temple, Narayan Maharaj is in charge of. Keshava Maharaj was the sannyasi from whom Prabhupada took sannyas initiation. And Narayan Maharaj was apparently personally there and performed the fire sacrifice when he was just a young brahmachari. And so then Narayan Maharaj has been preaching for a long time. He now must be close to 80 years old. He's been preaching for a long time in the Mathura region. He also has another temple now in Vrindavan. That's his headquarters. And he was very friendly with ISKCON. He helped us in several ways. And Prabhupada asked, when devotees asked Prabhupada, when Prabhupada was about to leave, how we would know how to conduct a funeral ceremony to put him in his samadhi, he suggested that devotees go to Narayan Maharaj, which they did. So there was a relationship. But sometime about 5 years ago, maybe a little longer ago, some senior people began going to Narayan Maharaj regularly for instruction in Krishna consciousness. He was giving them a class. It started out with the Brahma Samhita, and over the course of the time, it gradually changed into Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti. And it created something of a crisis because he was introducing this into ISKCON. And then finally, we had a big discussion on it on the GBC because there were some GBC members who were going to him. And they all agreed to stop. When that happened, by that time, Narayan Maharaj had a kind of big following in ISKCON. And when the senior people stopped going to see him, he became greatly offended by that. As very angry at the GBC and at ISKCON for doing that. And since that time, he started every summer touring around ISKCON centers all over the world, reinitiating disciples of ISKCON gurus, and generally trying to gain followers from ISKCON. That thing is a particular issue. But the GBC suggests that doesn't think that's a good idea for people to go and hear from him. So I was just explaining my particular problem with what he's doing. The issue to me is not whether somebody's an advanced devotee or a good devotee or not. No, that's not really the issue. The issue is who really has the correct, is taking the correct course to carry on, to push the Sankirtan movement on in a correct way. The next step, the next step, the next step. And he can go and preach all he wants. I think it's fine. But I don't want, my conviction is that Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta set it on the right course, and it's my duty as Prabhupada's disciple to keep it going in the same way. And that's why I feel very much the interference of people like Narayan Maharaj and ISKCON. If he went and had his own movement, well, let's just see who comes out successful. Fine, you know, no problem. But unfortunately, it tends to interfere a little bit with ISKCON. And because we've had weaknesses and difficulties and spiritual masters falling down, people are feeling insecure and nervous about their future and want to know if ISKCON has the real thing or if you can go back to Godhead and all this other kind of stuff. And so then they become, because of that weakness, they become susceptible to these kinds of appeals. I think ISKCON has problems, but I don't think going to Narayan Maharaj is the way to fix them. I think it'll make it worse. That's my judgment on this matter. What else do you want to know about this?
There's one doubt I would like to air out here, and that was that the GBC, it sounds like a Western idea, the British Railroad, and like a kind of political arrangement. Somebody with a sharp memory from around here could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in the mid-80s we heard this idea or criticism in connection with remember the Varnashram revolution we had here, I think it was 84. And at that time I think there was some criticism of like the idea of corporate structure and that, you know, actually ISKCON should be organized by the, you know, the Vedic system of the Varnashrama.
You think your corporate, you got an analysis where corporate structure and Varnashram Dharma, Varnashram, are incompatible? I don't see it necessarily incompatible.
It's necessary to spread the Krishna.
Yeah, it is. Anyway, I mean, you have to judge what's compatible and what's not compatible. Certainly the fact that something is Western. Remember what Bhaktisiddhanta did. At a certain point, he took a pilgrimage to Radhakund, where all the Babaji's were. He pulled up to Radhakund in a Pierce Arrow, you know, like a sort of a Rolls Royce. Rolled right up in a Rolls Royce and Radhakund. And he was making a point. It wasn't just to, you know, go in your faces and shock them, but he was making a point that these kinds of things, you know, this automobile was not invented in India. It's not a product of Vedic culture. It was lent to him by Lord so-and-so. I mean, I don't know, one of the princely Maharajas who had probably 16 of them, I don't. But anyway, he used everything in Krishna's service. The same thing with the printing press. That was another innovation. But the Brihat Madanga. So he was all for it. Utility is the principle. And so people like Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada, they're the people that have to choose, you know, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, what works and what doesn't work. So I don't see that, in some ways a corporate structure is really nice. I think, especially in a Brahminical organization, so that people, because it's a structure of cooperation, I think it could work quite well, and it does go back to a certain notion of a kind of Vaishnava Sangha, which is in a way less hierarchical and more egalitarian than maybe some other traditional models, and I think that's fine. I don't have a problem with it myself. I don't say that, you know, you'll keep the same structure exactly. It won't undergo some changes either in the course of using it, because again, to me, the only way to find out what works and what doesn't work, ultimately, is you have to try something and see if it works. You use your best judgment, then you try something, you see if it works. If it doesn't, then you go back to the drawing board and try it another way. The Prabhupada authorized this process. He said, you learn from experience, and experience means you make mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. The thing that's bad is not to learn from them, to keep making the same mistake over and over and over again. If you can't learn from experience, then you're a fool. That becomes the problem. So I think in our case, the what we really have to do is try to achieve real wisdom. I think we are looking at a history of mistakes and of failure, and the reason to examine it is to find out what went wrong, what were the problems, what's at stake, and in this broad picture find out how we can go on and do next. I'm convinced that this is not over with by far. I think real wisdom to me means actually being able to maintain your ideals, but in the face of actual fact. Not that you maintain your ideals by going around with your eyes closed, but that you actually understand and see what happens. Now maybe we people who join this movement, we start off as being kind of foolish idealism. You know, you think that your cause is pure and your aims are noble, so everything you do is pure and noble automatically, and nothing can go wrong. And then you become disillusioned. Things start to go wrong, and then you go from being a foolish idealist to a foolish cynic. There are no truth, there are no ideas, everything is fake, everything is phony, everyone has feet of clay, you know, by a kind of just sort of automatic reaction. I think most of human history is like this. People are doing something from one time and they find out it's foolish and they just go, okay, so now we'll do just the opposite thing, which is another foolishness, without actually thinking it through. So our idea is we have to learn how to, from experience, that to maintain our principles and learn how to, with a cool head, as Prabhupada said, with a cool head, to apply them in new circumstances as they develop. And to me, the only way to do this is to look and see what happened. And in the course of this, I'm going to try to analyze our own failures and our own circumstances, see where try to figure out what exactly, in a way, really went wrong and what we can do to make some correction so it doesn't continue. without any improvement. I don't think it's going to become perfect right off the bat. The next tomorrow, I'm going to talk about. Tomorrow's a long day. We got a whole bunch of things. We're going to talk about what happened in ISKCON, and I want to talk about some of the crises Prabhupada had to deal with, and what was it, what was at stake there. This is to give you an idea of what was really going on with Prabhupada. I'm going to talk about Black Keith.
Black Keith Ham.
Kirtananda. He showed up in 1967 with basically the same program that he was trying to pull off 20 years later. Showed up in, dressed as a Christian priest with his sikha shaved off. The first big crisis, Kirtananda showed up dressed as a Christian. He'd just gotten sannyas and was preaching Mayavad philosophy. Then we're going to talk about what happened a little bit thereafter.
Literally,
I think
he showed up in black.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and told everybody this is what Prabhupada wanted them to do, and this is the way you're going to have to spread Krishna consciousness.
At 2767.
Yeah.
20 seconds.
Yeah, you want the story? I mean, shall I start? Do you want to go on for another half hour? Get a head start. I mean, people, might, if you're tired, you know, maybe it's not a good idea. Yeah. The next story we'll talk about is when. Ban Maharaj, Prabhupada's godbrother in Vrindavan, had started to preach to, reinitiate some of Prabhupada's disciples and started to try to convince Prabhupada's disciples that Prabhupada was bogus. He wasn't authorized. And under his influence, the two biggest leaders in ISKCON, Brahmananda and Gargamuni, conspired to take ISKCON away from Prabhupada. Did you know Prabhupada do this? His big lead. These are two of his big leaders. Kirtananda was his first sannyasi, and he basically tried to do it. And then Brahmananda and Gargamuni tried to do it. These are the good old days, right?
Is this the behind-the-scenes story of this chapter in Leelamrita called The Threat Against ISKCON?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. And that led to the formation of the GBC, by the way. That's when Prabhupada put the GBC together. Then the same guys, then the next crisis, the same people had a change of heart and decided that Prabhupada was God. And then there was another big crisis, which is also covered in Leelamrita, but not maybe in so much detail, is the fratricidal war with the Radha-Damodar traveling party and the war between the householders and sannyasis, sort of like the daksha kind of a thing. You know, in fact, they use that story. I don't know if I'll have time, but there was a...
76, right?
Yeah. And before that, sometime in the mid-70s, maybe 74, 75, there was Bali Mardan in New York and Natasha Toyota. That was a very far-out thing that happened. Yeah. A very far-out thing. I didn't get a time to talk about that one in Radhadesh. That's what's on the agenda.
You'll put that one in here, although
yeah. You know, just if you want to sit and listen, I'll tell you the stories. You know.
We're all ears.
Yeah. We're scheduled to 7 o'clock now. We can stay for a while. I can start, or we can want to go on for another half hour. Or do people have other appointments? You want to leave and go somewhere else? Huh? I don't know what to do. Take a vote. How many people want to continue? How many people want to stop now? Huh? A few people. You have to go back to town.
Yeah,
huh?
I have to go back to town.
Yeah, so that's okay. Because you have to leave and you got to go milk a cow or something. Black Keith. And the other things. You mean something positive? That won't happen to me. Yeah, I think so.
This is quite exciting.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada ki.
Yeah.